The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner by Alan Sillitoe. As soon as I got to Borstal, they made me a long-distance cross-country runner. I suppose they thought I was just the build for it, because I was long and skinny for my age, and I still am. And in any case, I didn't mind it much, to tell you the truth, because running had always been made much of in our family, especially running away from the police. I've always been a good runner, quick and with a big stride as well. The only trouble being that no matter how fast I run, and I did a very fair lick even though I do say it myself, it didn't stop me getting caught by the cops after that bakery job. You might think it a bit rare having long-distance cross-country runners in Borstal, thinking that the first thing a long-distance cross-country runner would do when they set him loose at them fields and woods would be to run as far away from the place as he could get, on a bellyful of Borstal slumgullion. But you're wrong, and I'll tell you why. The first thing is that them bastards over us aren't as daft as they most of the time look. And for another thing, I'm not so daft as I would look if I tried to make a break for it on me long-distance running, because to abscond and then get caught is nothing but a mug's game, and I'm not falling for it. Cunning is what counts in this life, and even then you've got to use it in the slyest way you can. I'm telling you straight, they're cunning and I'm cunning. If only them and us had the same ideas, we'd get on like a house on fire. But they don't see eye to eye with us, and we don't see eye to eye with them. So that's how it stands, and how it always will stand. The one fact is that all of us are cunning, and because of this there's no love lost between us. So the thing is, they know that I won't try to get away from them. They sit there like spiders in that crumbly manor house, perched like jumped-up jackdaws on the roof, watching out over the drives and fields like German generals from the tops of tanks. And even when I jog-trot on behind a wood and they can't see me any more, they know my sweeping brush head will bob along that hedge top in an hour's time, and that I'll report to the bloke on the gate. Because when on a raw and frosty morning I get up at 5 o'clock and stand shivering me belly off on the stone floor, and all the rest still have another hour to snooze before the bells go, I slink downstairs through all the corridors to the big outside door with a permit running card in me fist. I feel like the first and last man on the world, both at once, if you can believe what I'm trying to say. I feel like the first man because I've hardly got a stitch on, and I'm sent against the frozen fields in a shimmy and shorts. Even the first poor bastard dropped onto the earth in midwinter knew how to make a suit of leaves or how to skin a pterodactyl for a top coat. So there I am, frozen stiff, with nothing to get me warm except a couple of hours long-distance running before breakfast, not even a slice of bread and sheep dip. They're training me up fine for the big sports day, when all the pig-faced, snotty-nosed dukes and ladies, who can't add two and two together and would mess themselves like loonies if they didn't have slaves to beck and call, come and make speeches to us about sports being just the thing to get us leading an honest life and keeping our itching finger ends off them shop locks and safe handles and hair grips to open gas meters. They give us a bit of blue ribbon and a cup for a prize after we've shagged ourselves out running or jumping, like racehorses. Only we don't get so well looked after as racehorses, that's the only thing. So there I am, standing in the doorway in shimmy and shorts, not even a dry crust in me guts, looking out at the frosty flowers on the ground. I suppose you think this is enough to make me cry. Not likely. Just because I feel like the first bloke in the world wouldn't make me bawl. It makes me feel 50 times better than when I'm cooped up in that dormitory with 300 others. No, it's sometimes when I stand there feeling like the last man in the world that I don't feel so good. I feel like the last man in the world because I think that all those 300 sleepers behind me are dead. They sleep so well, I think that every scruffy head's kicked the bucket in the night and I'm the only one left. And when I look out into the bushes and frozen ponds, I have the feeling that it's going to get colder and colder until everything I can see, meaning my red arms as well, is going to be covered with 1,000 miles of ice all over the land and sea. So I try to kick this feeling out and act like I'm the first man on the earth. And that makes me feel good. So as soon as I'm steamed up enough to get this feeling in me, I take a flying leap out of the doorway, and off I trot. I'm in Essex. It's supposed to be a good Borstal. At least that's what the governor said to me when I first got there from Nottingham. We want to trust you while you're in this establishment, he said, smoothing out his newspaper with lily-white, workless hands while I read the big words upside down, Daily Telegraph. If you play ball with us, we'll play ball with you. Honest to God, you'd have thought it was going to be one long tennis match. We want hard, honest work, and we want good athletics, he said as well. And if you give us both these things, you can be sure we'll do right by you and send you back into the world an honest man. I could have died laughing, especially when straight after this I heard the barking Sergeant Major's voice calling me and two others to attention and marching us off like we was Grenadier Guards. And when the Governor kept saying how we wanted you to do this and we wanted you to do that, I kept looking around for the other blokes, wondering how many of them there was. Of course, I knew there were thousands of them. But as far as I knew, only one was in the room. And there are thousands of them. All over the pox-eaten country. In shops, offices, railway stations, cars, houses, pubs. In-law blokes like you and them. All on the watch for outlaw blokes like me and us. And waiting to phone for the coppers as soon as we make a false move. And it'll always be there, I'll tell you that now. Because I haven't finished making all my false moves yet, and I dare say I won't until I kick the bucket. If the in-laws are hoping to stop me making false moves, they're wasting their time. They might as well stand me up against a wall and let fly with a dozen rifles. That's the only way they'll stop me and a few million others. Because I've been doing a lot of thinking since coming here. They can spy on us all day to see if we're pulling our puddings or if we're working good, or doing our athletics, but they can't make an x-ray of our guts to find out what we're telling ourselves. I've been asking myself all sorts of questions and thinking about my life up to now. And I like doing this. It's a treat. It passes the time away and don't make Borstal seem half so bad as the boys in our street used to say it was. And this long-distance running lark's the best of all, because it makes me think so good that I learn things even better than when I'm on my bed at night. And apart from that, what with thinking so much while I'm running, I'm getting to be one of the best runners in the Borstal. I can go me 5 miles round better than anybody else I know. So as soon as I tell myself I'm the first man ever to be dropped into the world, and as soon as I take that first flying leap out into the frosty grass of an early morning, when even birds haven't the heart to whistle, I get to thinking. And that's what I like. I go me rounds in a dream, turning at lane or footpath corners without knowing I'm turning, leaping brooks without knowing they're there, and shouting good morning to the early cow milker without seeing him. It's a treat being a long-distance runner, out in the world by yourself, with not a soul to make you bad-tempered or tell you what to do, or that there's a shop to break and enter a bit back from the next street. Sometimes I think that I've never been so free as during that couple of hours when I'm trotting up the path out of the gates and turning by that bare-faced, big-bellied oak tree at the lane end. Everything's dead, but good, because it's dead before coming alive, not dead after being alive. That's how I look at it. Mind you, I often feel frozen stiff at first. I can't feel me hands or feet or flesh at all, like I'm a ghost who wouldn't know the earth was under him, if he didn't see it now and again through the mist. But even though some people would call this frost pain suffering if they wrote about it to their mams in a letter, I don't. Because I know that in half an hour I'm going to be warm. That by the time I get to the main road and am turning onto the wheat field footpath by the bus stop, I'm going to feel as hot as a pot-bellied stove and as happy as a dog with a tin tail. It's a good life, I'm saying to myself, if you don't give in to coppers and Borstal bosses and the rest of them bastard-faced in-laws. For I'm 17 now, and when they let me out of this, if I don't make a break and see that things turn out otherwise, they'll try to get me in the army. And what's the difference between the army and this place I'm in now? They can't kid me, the bastards. I've seen the barracks near where I live, and if there weren't swaddies on guard outside with rifles, you wouldn't know the difference between their high walls and the place I'm in now. Even though the swaddies come out at odd times a week for a pint of ale, so what? Don't I come out 3 mornings a week on me long-distance running, which is 50 times better than boozing? When they first said that I was to do me long-distance running without a guard pedalling beside me on a bike, I couldn't believe it. But they called it a progressive, a modern place. Though they can't kid me, because I know it's just like any other borstal, going by the stories I've heard. Except that they let me trot about like this. Borstal's borstal, no matter what they do. But anyway, I moaned about it being a bit thick, sending me out so early to run 5 miles on an empty stomach, until they talked me round to thinking it wasn't so bad, which I knew all the time. Until they called me a good sport, and patted me on the back when I said I'd do it, and that I'd try to win them the Borstal Blue Ribbon Prize Cup for Long Distance Cross Country Running All England. And now the governor talks to me when he comes on his rounds, almost as he'd talk to his prize racehorse, if he had one. "All right, Smith," he asks. "Yes, sir," I answer. He flicks his grey moustache. "How's the running coming along?" "I've set myself to trot round the grounds after dinner, just to keep me hand in, sir," I tell him. The pot-bellied, pop-eyed bastard gets pleased at this. "Good show. I know you'll get us that cup," he says. And I swear under me breath, like boggery I will. No, I won't get them that cup, even though the stupid, tash-twitching bastard has all his hopes in me. Because what does his balmy hope mean, I ask myself. It don't mean a bloody thing to me, only to him. And it means as much to him as it would mean to me if I picked up the racing paper and put me bet on a hot I didn't know, had never seen, and didn't care a sod if I ever did see. That's what it means to him. And I lose that race, because I'm not a racehorse at all, and I let him know it when I'm about to get out. By Christ, I will. I'm a human being, and I've got thoughts and secrets and bloody life inside me that he doesn't know's there, and he'll never know what's there, because he's stupid. I suppose you'll laugh at this, me saying the governor's a stupid bastard, when I hardly know how to write, and he can read and write and add up like a professor. But what I say is true, right enough. He's stupid, and I'm not, because I can see further into the likes of him than he can see into the likes of me. Admitted, we're both cunning, but I'm more cunning, and I'll win in the end, even if I die in jail at 82, because I'll have more fun and fire out of my life than he'll ever get out of his. He's read 1,000 books, I suppose, and for all I know he might even have written a few. But I know for a dead cert, as sure as I'm sitting here, that what I'm scribbling down is worth 1,000,000 to what he could ever scribble down. I don't care what anybody says, but that's the truth and can't be denied. I know when he talks to me, and I look into his army mug, that I'm alive and he's dead. He's as dead as a doornail. If he ran 10 yards, he'd drop dead. If he got 10 yards into what goes on in my guts, he'd drop dead as well, with surprise. At the moment, it's dead blokes like him as have the whip hand over blokes like me. And I'm almost dead sure it'll always be like that. But even so, by Christ, I'd rather be like I am, always on the run and breaking into shops for a packet of fags and a jar of jam, than have the whip hand over somebody else and be dead from the toenails up. Maybe as soon as you get the whip hand over somebody else, you go dead. By God, to say that last sentence has needed a few 100 miles of long-distance running. I could no more have said that at first than I could have took a £1,000,000 note from my back pocket. It's true, you know. Now I think of it again, and always has been true, and always will be true. And I'm surer of it every time I see the governor open that door and say, "Good morning, lads." As I run and see me smoky breath going out into the air as if I'd had 10 cigars stuck in different parts of me body, I think more on the little speech the governor made when I first came. Honesty. Be honest. I laughed so much one morning, I went 10 minutes down in me time because I had to stop and get rid of the stitch in me side. The governor was so worried when I got back late that he sent me to the doctors for an x-ray and a heart check. Be honest. It's like saying, be dead like me. Then you'll have no more pain of leaving your nice slummy house for Borstal or prison. Be honest and settle down in a cosy £6 a week job. Well, Even with all this long-distance running, I haven't yet been able to decide what he means by this, although I'm just about beginning to. And I don't like what it means. Because after all my thinking, I found that it adds up to something that can't be true about me, being born and brought up as I was. Because another thing people like that governor will never understand is that I am honest. There's never been anything else but honest, and that I'll always be honest. Sounds funny, but it's true. Because I know what honest means according to me, and he only knows what it means according to him. I think my honesty is the only sort in the world, and he thinks his is the only sort in the world as well. That's why this dirty, great, walled-up and fenced-up manor house in the middle of nowhere has been used to coop up blokes like me. And if I had the whip hand, I wouldn't even bother to build a place like this to put all the cops, governors, posh whores, pen pushers, army officers, members of parliament in. No. I'd stick 'em up against a wall and let 'em have it. Like they'd ever done with blokes like us years ago, that is, if they'd ever known what it means to be honest, which they don't, and never will, so help me God Almighty. I was nearly 18 months in Borstal before I thought about getting out. I can't tell you much about what it was like there, because I haven't got the hang of describing buildings, or saying how many crummy chairs and slatted windows make a room. Neither can I do much complaining, because to tell you the truth, I didn't suffer in Borstal at all. I gave the same answer a pal of mine gave when someone asked him how much he hated it in the army. I didn't hate it, he said. They fed me, gave me a suit and pocket money, which was a bloody sight more than I ever got before, unless I worked myself to death for it. And most of the time they wouldn't let me work, but sent me to the Dole office twice a week. Well, that's more or less what I say. Borstal didn't hurt me in that respect. So since I've got no complaints, I don't have to describe what they gave us to eat, what the dorms were like, and how they treated us. But in another way, Borstal does something to me. No, it doesn't get me back up, because it's always been up, right from when I was born. What it does is show me what they've been trying to frighten me with. They've got other things as well, like prison and, in the end, the rope. It's like me rushing up to thump a man and snatch the coat off his back, when suddenly I pull up because he whips out a knife and lifts it to stick me like a pig if I come too close. That knife is Borstal, clink, the rope. But once you've seen the knife, you learn a bit of unarmed combat. You have to, because you'll never get that sort of knife in your own hands, and this unarmed combat doesn't amount to much. Still, there it is. And you keep on rushing up to this man, knife or not, hoping to get one of your hands on his wrist, and the other on his elbow, both at the same time, and press back until he drops the knife. You see, by sending me to Borstal, they've shown me the knife, and from now on I know something I didn't know before, that it's war between me and them. I always knew this, naturally, because I was in remand home as well, and the boys there told me a lot about their brothers in Borstal, but it was only touch and go then, like kittens, like boxing gloves, like Dobby. But now that they've shown me the knife, whether I ever pinch another thing in my life again or not, I know who my enemies are and what war is. They can drop all the atom bombs they like for all I care. I'll never call it war and wear a soldier's uniform, because I'm in a different sort of war that they think is child's play. The war they think is war is suicide, and those that go and get killed in war should be put in clink for attempted suicide, because that's the feeling in blokes' minds when they rush to join up or let themselves be called up. I know, because I've thought how good it would be sometimes to do myself in, and the easiest way to do it, it occurred to me, was to hope for a big war so that I could join up and get killed. But I got past that when I knew I already was in a war of my own, that I was born into one, that I grew up hearing the sound of old soldiers who'd been over the top at Dartmoor, half-killed at Lincoln, trapped in no man's land at Borstal, that sounded louder than any Jerry bombs. Government wars aren't my wars. They've got nought to do with me, because my own war's all that I'll ever be bothered about. I remember when I was 14 and I went out into the country with three of my cousins, all about the same age, who later went to different Borstals, and then to different regiments, from which they soon deserted, and then to different jails, where they still are, as far as I know. But anyway, we were all kids then, and we wanted to go out to the woods for a change, to get away from the roads of stinking hot tar one summer. We climbed over fences and went through fields, scrumping a few sour apples on our way, until we saw the wood about a mile off. Up Collier's Pad we heard another lot of kids talking in high school voices behind a hedge. We crept up to them and peeped through the brambles, and saw they were eating a picnic, a real posh spread out of baskets and flasks and towels. There must have been about seven of them, lads and girls sent out by the mams and dads for the afternoon. So we went in on our bellies through the hedge like crocodiles and surrounded them, and then dashed into the middle, scattering the fire and batting their tabs and snatching up all that there was to eat, then running off over cherry orchard fields into the wood with a man chasing us who'd come up while we were ransacking their picnic. We got away all right and had a good feed into the bargain, because we'd been clamped to death and couldn't wait long enough to get our chops ripping into them thin lettuce and ham sandwiches and creamy cakes. Well, I'll always feel, during every bit of me life, like those daft kids should have felt before we broke them up. But they never dreamed that what happened was going to happen. Just like the governor of this Borstal, who spouts to us about honesty and all that whoppy stuff, don't know a bloody thing. While I know, every minute of my life, that a big boot is always likely to smash any nice picnic I might be balmy and dishonest enough to make for myself. I admit there have been times when I've thought of telling the governor all this so as to put him on his guard, but when I've got as close as seeing him, I've changed my mind, thinking to let him either find out for himself or go through the same mill as I've gone through. I'm not hard-hearted. In fact, I've helped a few blokes in my time with the odd one, and they've been on the run. But I'm boggered if I'm going to risk being put in the cells just for trying to give the governor a bit of advice he don't deserve. If my heart's soft, I know the sort of people I'm going to save it for. And any advice I give to the governor wouldn't do him the least bit of good. It'd only trip him up sooner than if he wasn't told at all, which I suppose is what I want to happen. But for the time being, I'll let things go on as they are, which is something else I've learned in the last year or two. It's a good job I can only think of these things as fast as I can write with this stub of pencil that's clutched in me paw. Otherwise I'd have dropped the whole thing weeks ago. By the time I'm halfway through my morning course, when after a frostbitten dawn I can see a phlegmy bit of sunlight hanging from the bare twigs of beech and sycamore, and when I've measured me halfway mark by the shortcut scrimmage down the steep bush-covered bank and into the sunken lane, and there's still not a soul in sight, and not a sound except the neighing of a piebald foal in a cottage stable that I can't see, I get to thinking the deepest and daftest of all. The governor would have a fit if he could see me sliding down the bank because I could break my neck or ankle, but I can't not do it, because it's the only risk I take, and the only excitement I ever get. Flying flat out like one of them pterodactyls from the Lost World I once heard on the wireless, crazy like a cut-bald cockerel, scratching myself to bits, and almost letting myself go, but not quite. It's the most wonderful minute, because there's not one thought or word or picture of anything in my head while I'm going down. I'm empty as I was before I was born, and I don't let myself go, I suppose, because whatever it is that's farthest down inside me don't want me to die or hurt myself bad. And it's daft to think deep, you know, because it gets you nowhere, though deep is what I am when I've passed this halfway mark, because the long-distance run of an early morning makes me think that every run like this is a life, a little life, I know, but a life as full of misery and happiness and things happening as you can ever get really around yourself. And I remember that after a lot of these runs I thought that it didn't need much know-how to tell how a life was going to end once it had got well started. But as usual I was wrong, caught first by the cops and then by my own bad brain. I could never trust myself to fly scot-free over these traps, was always tripped up sooner or later, no matter how many I got over to the good without even knowing it. Looking back, I suppose them big trees put their branches to their snouts and gave each other a good wink. And there I was, whizzing down the bank and not seeing a bloody thing. I don't say to myself, you shouldn't have done the job, and then you'd have stayed away from Borstal. No, what I ram into my runner brain is that my luck had no right to scram just when I was on my way to making the coppers think I hadn't done the job after all. The time was autumn, and the night foggy enough to set me and my mate Mike roaming the streets when we should have been rooted in front of the telly and stuck into a plush, posh seat at the pictures. But I was restless after 6 weeks away from any sort of work, and well you might ask me why I'd been bone idle for so long, because normally I sweated my thin guts out on a milling machine with the rest of them. But you see, my dad died from cancer of the throat, and Mam collected a cool 500 in insurance and benefits from the factory where he'd worked. For your bereavement, they said, or words like that. Now I believe, and my Mam must have thought the same, that a wad of crisp blueback fivers ain't a sight of good to a living soul, unless they're flying out of your hand into some shopkeeper's till, and the shopkeeper is passing you tip-top things in exchange over the counter. So as soon as she got the money, Mam took me and my five brothers and sisters out to town and got us dolled up in new clothes. Then she ordered a 21-inch telly, a new carpet because the old one was covered with blood from Dad's dying and wouldn't wash out, and took a taxi home with bags of grub and a new fur coat. And do you know, you won't believe when I tell you, she'd still nearly 300 left in a bulging handbag the next day, so how could any of us go to work after that? Poor old Dad, he didn't get a look in. And he was the one who'd done the suffering and dying for such a lot of lolly.